newsyou're not supposed to know.com. Coming up next, it's Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell, her weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Per Fagerang talks to investigative historian Gareth Porter about John Bolton's push for war with Iran. At 10 o'clock on the Heather McCoy Show, Heather talks to Timothy DeVevi, who is the author of Freak Kingdom, Hunter S. Thompson's Manic 10-Year Crusade Against American Fascism. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, David Naiman talks to author Cristina Rivera Garza about her new detective novel, The Taiga Syndrome. KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. It's 9 o'clock and Teresa Mitchell's next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Lessons for a New Generation of Organizers. A talk with David Rainey on Thursday, May 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ask Me Union Hall in Portland. David Rainey, Professor Emeritus in the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He is also the author of the new book, Living and Dying on the Factory Floor, From Outside In and the Inside Out. The event is also sponsored by the Institute of Anarchist Studies and the Burgerville Workers Union. Again, that's Lessons for a New Generation of Organizers, a talk with David Rainey on Thursday, May 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ask Me Union Hall, 6025 East Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Today I want to talk about the saber-rattling versus Iran, coming from John Bolton and All of the actors that you would expect, I think, in Washington. And I will invite your calls on that. First, I want to go to headlines. Ilana Novick, writing in Truth Dig, says two conservative former Democratic senators, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota and Joe Donnelly of Indiana, have launched the One Country Project, a 501c4 not-for-profit organization that aims to attract rural voters to the Democratic Party. However, according to MapLight's Andrew Perez, working in partnership with The Intercept, the organization is also a dark money group using the former lawmakers to push an anti-Medicare for All agenda. Perez found that the One Country Project's website is registered to an executive at Forbes Tate Partners, a lobbying and public relations firm founded by former Clinton administration officials. Forbes Tate Partners is leading lobbying efforts for Partnership for America's Healthcare Future, or PAHCF, which according to MapLight is a health industry-backed nonprofit created to crush momentum for a comprehensive universal healthcare system. So if you're interested in universal healthcare, you should know that the opposition to your interest is well-organized and well-funded. Trump officials are excited about the amount of civilian suffering that they have been able to produce in Venezuela by doubling down on the program of sanctions started under the Obama administration in 2013. Earlier this year, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was quoted saying, quote, "The circle is tightening. The humanitarian crisis is increasing by the hour. I talked with our senior person on the ground there in Venezuela last night. You can see the increasing pain and suffering that the Venezuelan people are suffering from," end quote. W.T. Whitney, writing in Counterpunch, quotes a U.S. official associated with the Mexican embassy, saying, quote, "The economic sanctions we've imposed on the Venezuelan government have caused it to stop making payments as much as on its sovereign debt as on PDVSA, its oil company. We are seeing a total economic collapse. Therefore, our policy is working," end quote. The U.S. is also using sanctions in the banking sector to stop food shipments and even insulin for diabetes patients, resulting in 40,000 additional deaths per year now. Meanwhile, Trump officials and supporters are gloating, claiming the deaths from this ongoing bipartisan racist cowardly aggression are due to socialism. I'll be talking more about stopping diabetes medicine. I think maybe that's something that can just kind of strike home. A lot of Americans have diabetes. What happens when they don't get their medicine? You know how ugly it is. From Radio Havana, Cuba, in technology news, WhatsApp is urging its 1.5 billion users to update their apps after it was revealed hackers found a way to remotely install surveillance software on smartphones and other personal devices via the popular messaging app. The attack was reportedly orchestrated by Israeli security firm NSO Group. NSO has been implicated in surveillance efforts on behalf of Saudi and Mexican governments. The Committee to Protect Journalists warned that journalists, lawyers, activists, and human rights defenders were the most likely targets of the attack. WhatsApp is owned by Facebook. Also from Radio Havana, Cuba. The U.S. State Department has ordered the pullout of the employees from both the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad and its consulate in Erbil, the embassy said in a statement. Quote, normal visa services at both posts will be temporarily suspended, end quote. It was recommending those affected depart as soon as possible. It is unclear how many staff would leave. And speaking for myself, the reason I'm repeating this news is because although this is probably purely a propaganda move, it is also a practical move in the event of hostilities. Returning to the article from Radio Havana, Cuba, the pullout of its non-emergency personnel from Iraq is a precautionary move in light of what Washington claims is a credible and possibly imminent attack by Iranian-backed groups in the Middle Eastern nation. Earlier this week, the U.S. military reaffirmed concerns about possible imminent threats from Iran to its troops in Iraq, although a senior British commander cast doubt on that, and Tehran has called it psychological warfare. U.S. President Donald Trump's administration has stepped up sanctions pressure by ending waivers for some countries to purchase Iranian oil, part of efforts to roll back the Islamic Republic's expanding regional clout. Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdul Mahdi said on Tuesday he was getting indications from talks with both the United States and Iran that things will end well despite the rhetoric. Iran released a statement earlier this week saying that they were not seeking war with the United States, nor were they planning to launch any attacks against their forces. Of course, this comes in the context of some explosives which apparently were set off against the hulls of oil tankers. This is pretty clearly a case of U.S. Navy SEALs delivering the explosives in a Trump administration stunt to create the atmosphere for hostilities, for actually engaging in some level of warfare. You can see that they were large explosives, but small in impact compared to the size of the tankers. And you can see that they did not puncture the inner hull of the tankers. It's a feeble stunt. And I have to wonder if that is it or if something else is being cooked up. There are reports now that President Trump is dragging his feet on provocations versus Iran or against going to war with Iran. Of course, all of this is coming out of John Bolton and Pompeo, who very much seem to be advocating for, well, a multi-front war, one against Venezuela and Iran and Cuba, and who knows where else. To give some background to this, I have some information which is easily found, really. Didn't go further than Wikipedia for much of it. About history of Iran, and I want to present that, and I want to get your opinions on hostilities versus Iran. My take on it so far is neither country has good reason to go to war at this point. The U.S. doesn't really have the resources in the region, despite the encirclement of bases and the presence of aircraft carrier groups in the Persian Gulf. The U.S. doesn't have the troops to occupy Iran. Just to put it briefly, Iran doesn't have a reason to be setting off small bombs against large tankers. That's so obviously a stunt, it scarcely bears mention. But interested to know what you think. 503-231-8187. From Wikipedia, Reza Shah ruled for almost 16 years until September 16th, 1941. And that's where I've decided to start this, 1941, Second World War. When he was forced to abdicate by the Anglo-Soviet invasion of Iran, he established an authoritarian government that valued nationalism, militarism, secularism, and anti-communism combined with strict censorship and state propaganda. Reza Shah introduced many socioeconomic reforms, reorganizing the army, government administration, and finances. He put in rails and that sort of thing. I'm skipping ahead. Many of the new laws and regulations created resentment among devout Muslims and the clergy. For example, mosques were required to use chairs. Most men were required to wear Western clothing, including a hat with a brim. Women were encouraged to discard the hijab. Men and women were allowed to freely congregate, violating Islamic mixing of the sexes. Tensions boiled over in 35 when Bazaris and villagers rose up in rebellion, chanting slogans such as, "The Shah is a new Yazid." Yazid be a hated 7th century figure. Skipping ahead, German interests held great influence within Iran in 1941, with the Germans staging a coup in an attempt to overthrow the Pahlavi dynasty. With German armies highly successful against Russia, the Iranian government expected Germany to win the war and establish a powerful force on its borders. It rejected British and Russian demands to expel the Germans. In response, the Allies invaded in August 41 and easily overwhelmed the weak Iranian army in Operation Countenance. Iran became the major conduit of Allied lend-lease aid to the Soviet Union. The purpose was to secure Iranian oil fields and ensure Allied supply lines. Iran remained officially neutral. Its monarch, Reza Shah, was deposed during the subsequent occupation and replaced with his young son, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. At the Tehran Conference of 1943, so we're still talking about World War II, the Allies issued the Tehran Declaration, guaranteeing the post-war independence and boundaries of Iran. However, when the war actually ended, Soviet troops stationed in northwestern Iran not only refused to withdraw, but backed revolts that established a short-lived pro-Soviet separatist national states in the northern regions of Azerbaijan and Iranian Kurdistan. The Azerbaijan People's Government and the Republic of Kurdistan, respectively, in late 1945. Soviet troops did not withdraw from Iran proper until May 46, after receiving a promise of oil concessions, and it gets to be about oil as we go further into this. The oil in Iran had been set up with British oil companies since shortly after the turn of the 20th century. But returning to the Wikipedia, initially, there were hopes that post-occupation Iran would become a constitutional monarchy. The new young Shah, Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, initially took a very hands-off role in government, allowed parliament to hold a lot of power. Some elections were held in the first shaky years, though they remained mired in corruption. Skipping ahead, shortly thereafter, in 52... Well, I shouldn't skip that far, excuse me. In 1951, Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh received a vote required from Parliament to nationalize the British-owned oil industry. And if you hear a low, slow bell tolling portentously, then you'd be hearing right. The situation was known as the Abadan Crisis. It was a crisis, of course, for British and American oil companies. But returning to the text, despite British pressure, including an economic blockade, the nationalization continued. Mossadegh was briefly removed from power in 1952, but was quickly reappointed by the Shah due to a popular uprising in support of the premier, and he in turn forced the Shah into a brief exile in August 53 after a failed military coup by the Imperial Guard. Shortly thereafter, on August 19th, a successful coup was headed by the retired Army General Zahedi, organized by the United States CIA with the active support of the British MI6. This is known as Operation Ajax and Operation Boot. The coup, with a black propaganda campaign designed to turn the population against Mossadegh, forced Mossadegh from office. Mossadegh was arrested and tried for treason. So, speaking for myself, the elected government of Iran was overthrown in 1953 by the Americans and the British. Iran was ruled as an autocracy under the Shah, with American support from that time until the revolution. The Iranian government entered into an agreement with an international consortium of foreign companies, which ran the Iranian oil facilities for the next 25 years, splitting profits 50-50 with Iran, but not allowing Iran to audit their accounts or to have members on the board of directors. In 57, martial law was ended after 16 years, and Iran became closer to the West, joining the Baghdad Pact and receiving military and economic aid from the U.S. So my point here is that the U.S. has been messing with Iran for a long time. And the point of cornering Iran, surrounding Iran, and threatening war is, of course, to regain control of the oil assets. But Hossein is on the air. Hello,
Hi.
Hossein.
Hi. How are you doing?
Doing well.
Oh, yeah. I'm listening to your program, and then I'm looking at the mail message I have from Dr. Tehrani, and there is a show at Portland State University tonight through Sunday about Mohammad Mossadegh, Man of the Year. I thought it would be relevant, too, because that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yes, it's a show today, May 16th to May 19th. Is at different times, May 16th was at 7:30 p.m. Today and Saturday, through Saturday and Sunday as at 2 p.m. and is at the Lincoln Hall, 55.
Lincoln Hall, yeah, 55 at PSU.
Yeah, also called Boiler Room Theater.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and I don't know if you want the address is 1620 Southwest Park, Portland.
Okay, and once more, what time tonight?
Tonight is at 7:30 p.m. Okay, from tonight, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, it's at 7:30 p.m.
Okay,
and
well,
Sunday is at 2 p.m.
Well, that is very relevant. Thanks for calling in with that.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you. But student, $6, regular, $12.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much for all your effort.
Thanks very much. Well, stay tuned at 9:30. Para is going to be on with more about the threatened hostilities versus Iran. Revolution, now, skipping to the part that you probably already know about, revolutionaries, many of them students, took over in 1979, and you probably know that story with the Ayatollah moving in with, you know, the numbers in the organization to bend the government to his will. And I imagine it was rather like being ruled by Texas snake-handling Baptists. If you're getting old like me, you probably remember ABC's Nightline program every night with Ted Koppel keeping track of every day the U.S. Embassy in Tehran was occupied there by the revolutionaries and using that to stick it to then-President Carter, who wasn't conservative enough for Ted Koppel. Now I want to bring to you a couple of letters. One is from 1979. From Iranian students writing anonymously in the Harvard Crimson, and the other was written in the last week or so by Ellen Portaher, who is also an Iranian student. She is at SUNY Albany. But first, Iranian students writing in the Harvard Crimson back in 79 wrote in part, "The Shah systematically dismantled the judicial system of Iran and the country's guarantees of personal and social liberties. His regime consistently violated the codes of law and justice, destroying the dignity of our people by treating them like backward savages to be pulled with an iron hand out of the Middle Ages and into the light of the modern era. Nearly every source of creative, artistic, and intellectual endeavor in our culture was suppressed. The media said little about the 80% of peasant families remaining landless, about the growing shanty towns holding the displaced peasants, the misery and alienation of these people ripped from the traditional way of life and subjected to new economic and cultural pressures. The media had less to say about the 60% of adults left illiterate and the increasing income gap, which made Iran one of the world's most unequal societies. Little was heard about the royal family's financial scandals and their heroin smuggling on a global scale. The secret police SAVAK, trained by the CIA, conducted most of the torture. The CIA set up Slavik in 1957 and taught them how to interrogate suspects. Amnesty International reports methods of torture that included, quote, whipping and beating, electric shocks, extraction of teeth and nails, boiling water pumped into the won't say it, heavy weights hung on to the don't want to say that either, and you get the idea. The Shah greatly expanded the military and turned it against his own people. With newfound oil wealth, the Shah bought 200 million of U.S. arms, $200 million worth, that is. The U.S. military trained Iranian officers, despite claims that a strong army was needed to prevent external aggression. Its real purpose became clear last year, been written in 1979, when the army murdered more than 50,000 Iranians fighting the Shah, the numbers based on estimates of dead quickly buried after street massacres and compiled throughout the year. Under the Shah, education was a means of pacification. Our history books were full of lies about the glories of the Iranian dynasties, and they encouraged racism towards non-Persian-speaking minorities in Iran as well as nearby nations. A special military guard was stationed on most large university campuses to mute student opposition. The number of students tortured, lost, or murdered is unknown, yet the universities remained a bulwark of opposition to the Shah and his cultural aggression. So now I'll turn to Ellen Porterhurst's letter. And she wrote that this year. She is a PhD candidate in sociology at State University of New York, Albany. She works at the New York State Department of Health on programs that respond to the opioid crisis. Not a day goes by, she writes, without the Trump administration imposing a new challenge on us, the Iranian people. Those who think that the travel ban has been the hardest obstacle for Iranians need to catch up with the latest foreign policy developments. Encouraged by Donald Trump's foreign policy advisors, the Iranian people today face an increasing risk of military attack by the United States. Also, the Iranian currency has lost 80% of its value since last year, mainly reflecting the collective sense of fear caused by increased sanctions and the decertification of the Iran nuclear deal, as well as the increasing empowerment of the most undemocratic factions of the Iranian state. Trump has proudly taken credit for bankrupting an economy that feeds 80 million people, and he has recently promised to reduce Iran's oil exports to zero. And I want to speak for myself now and say this should remind you of what's being done to Venezuela. It requires a rather extensive effort by the U.S. going around the world, scotching deals, making people understand, making companies understand that if they make a deal with Venezuela or with Iran, they're going to be subject to the sanctions, meaning that they're going to be out of business at the very least. She writes, Iran is only marginally reflected in the U.S. news, which means the American public does not hear voices that express the human suffering caused by the U.S. government far beyond its borders. The murder and dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi Arabia, Trump's best ally in the region, is a rare instance of attention given to the nature of America's allies and Iran's opponents in the Middle East. Pro-democracy Iranians worldwide are experiencing a political trauma. They feel alienated from both internal and world politics. They are unable to communicate the debilitating pain of, on the one hand, expecting a military attack by the United States, and on the other, the worsening of the political landscape in their home country. Let them recall with comments and questions 503-231-8187. Returning to the letter, and this is from L.M. Porterhurst. Those who feel relieved by thinking that Trump will not engage in an actual war and is merely interested in making threats should realize that the war has already begun. U.S. sanctions are producing a level of suffering comparable to that of wartime. Sanctions, in fact, are a war waged by the United States against the Iranian working and middle classes. These groups struggle to make ends meet as unemployment dramatically increases, even as the inflation rate skyrockets. The same people that the Trump administration is pretending to want to set free are the ones that are hit hardest by current U.S. policies in the Middle East. She writes, I am a woman who grew up in Tehran. I arrived in the United States 7 years ago to pursue my studies in sociology. This decision was strongly shaped by my involvement in the peaceful pro-democracy movements of 2009. I've always opposed and continue to criticize the undemocratic elements of the Islamic Republic state. While my profession and studies are very meaningful to me, the political dramas silently affecting my homeland and my family on a routine basis make me feel alienated and utterly excluded from this society. I am weighed down by perpetual worry that my diabetic father is in danger of losing access to needed medication due to sanctions. My millennial friends are so consumed with anxiety over the possibility of war that their collective mental well-being is undermined, and they are unable to make any meaningful plans for their future. Living a double life between the United States and Iran, I struggle daily with moments of despair and alienation. I am simply unable to communicate my concerns with most caring colleagues at work and at school. U.S. civil society is so devoid of a voice representing my position that I struggle to find a way to verbalize my sense of panic, frustration, and despair. These fused feelings emerge because of the wall between me and the rest of society does not allow them to see the impact of the U.S. government's decision and lives live far from them, but so close to my heart. U.S. civil society needs to include more global perspectives on the country's foreign policy. U.S. citizens must become more aware that their votes have grave consequences beyond their country's borders. Although U.S. citizens are equipped with various safety nets and enjoy economic and military global superiority, their elected administration's foreign policy is a matter of life and death for the citizens of the other countries, especially in the Middle East. And she writes, for the United States to truly honor its claims to protect human rights and moral integrity, these issues need to be included in the upcoming election debates. So those are voices from Iran, one from 1979 and one far more recent. And I invite your calls. Coming up at 9:30, we'll have Per Fogring on much the same topic. And he will be talking about John Bolton. And so to introduce that, I have an article from truthdig.com. John Bolton is the world's worst nightmare. And it starts off with a quote of John Bolton in a March 26, 2015 New York Times op-ed headline, "To Stop Iran's Bomb, Bomb Iran." And the quote is, "Time is terribly short, but a strike can still succeed." They write, President Amy Goodman actually wrote this and writes, President Donald Trump campaigned as an isolationist, criticizing foreign military entanglements. As far back as 2013, he tweeted, quote, "Can you believe that the Afghan war is our longest war ever? Bring our troops home, rebuild the U.S., make America great again," end quote. He has made the point repeatedly as president. In an April 2018 press conference discussing Syria, Trump said, quote, "I want to get out. I want to bring our troops back home. I want to start rebuilding our nation. We will have, as of 3 months ago, $7 trillion in the Middle East over the last 17 years. We get nothing, nothing out of it, nothing," end quote. Despite his rhetoric, she writes, "Trump's every move in the Middle East now seems committed to conflict and potentially to war with Iran. John Bolton is clearly at the vanguard with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo backing him up." And there's much more to the article. I encourage you to read it. It is at truthdig.com. And also from Truthdig by Major Danny Sherson, "War with Iran is America's endgame." He writes, "Who do we think we are? Truly, the latest reports that the Trump administration is considering plans for deploying 120,000 troops to the Middle East, presumably to strike Iran, demonstrates how Washington's foreign policy has finally gone off the rails. Crazier still, the impending war with Iran isn't even today's biggest news story, what with all the nonsense soap opera hullabaloo about the Mueller report on mainstream media outlets. What the proposed plan constitutes is nothing less than the most important and disturbing global issue of the day. This is how it should be reported by a truly adversarial media. The United States is preparing for an aggressive, illegal, and unwarranted war against another sovereign power thousands of miles from its shores. Again, all true citizens should be beyond appalled and screaming dissent from the rooftops." Now, that is from Major Danny Sershon, and I disagree with him about the Mueller report, and I think it's quite relevant, and I think that obstruction of justice will come up more and more, and as a transgender and transsexual woman, I am experiencing daily the oppression of the demagogue and fascist Trump administration, and I want him out, and if this is the way, then I'm very excited about it. Danny Sherson is a major and a white man and thinks of things differently, so I'll just go ahead with one more paragraph that he writes. "The proposed plan comes on the heels of Iran's decision, prompted by U.S. hostility, to withdraw from certain, though not all, joint comprehensive plan of action, JCPOA, better known as the Iran nuclear deal requirements. This shouldn't come as any surprise. In fact, it's incredible that Iran stayed in compliance with the treaty as long as it did. After all, it was the United States that unilaterally scuttled the deal, which its own intelligence Services admitted Iran had complied with, against the advice of its European allies and even Secretary of State Tillerson. By reimposing sanctions on a compliant Iran, the U.S. acted aggressively and actually vindicated any Iranian counteraction. Indeed, President Rouhani had some justification for his claim that Tehran's move didn't violate the agreement per se, but actually the JCPOA permitted it since reimposition of sanctions was, quote, grounds to cease performing its commitments under this JCPOA in whole or in part, end quote. This staggering military plan, he writes, is only the latest escalation in a dangerous tit-for-tat game of chicken between Iran and the U.S. Furthermore, as Washington was, which has most often been the aggressor. The U.S., not Iran, recently deployed an aircraft carrier strike force and B-52 bombers to the Persian Gulf. The U.S., not Iran, needlessly began a provocative semantic battle, which when it designated the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps as a terror organization. So there's more to that article, which I recommend. It's in truthdig.com. And I've run out my half hour. It's now time for Fight the Empire. So do stay tuned to KBOO Portland, going out to you via 90.7 FM on our great big transmitter on the hill and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
With the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll host The Bail Trap on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. The Bail Trap features short films and speakers on bail fees in the United States. Money bail is one of the main causes of mass incarceration in the United States. Low-income Americans are sitting in jail for days, months, and even years simply because they cannot afford to pay high bail amounts. Films include Breaking Down, Deal with the Devil, How Much is Your Freedom Worth, and more. Again, that's The Bail Trap on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 9:31. Coming up next on Fight the Empire, host Per Fogren talks to investigative historian Gareth Porter about John Bolton's push for war with Iran.